Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, the Feast of Two Saints, Basil and Gregory. Bishops and doctors of the early church, these two famous orators helped establish the true faith and Eastern monasticism. The Magi in art. Who were the three wise men who visited Bethlehem? And what role have they played in Christian art throughout the ages? And how the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem educates thousands of Muslim and Christian children in peace in the land where Christ was born. They were bishops and doctors of the church who lived within the first 3 centuries after the death of Christ. Today, the Catholic Church celebrates their life and devotion to the faith on the 9th day in the octave of Christmas. Saints Basil the Great and Gregory of Nazianzen were friends who hailed from what is today modern-day Turkey and are considered the forefathers of Eastern Christian monasticism.
Saint Basil was born into a Christian family in Cappadocia sometime around the year AD 330. He was the eldest of 4 brothers, each of whom became bishops in their own right. Saint Basil the bishop was considered a great theologian and orator, as well as a courageous defender of the true faith threatened by the Arian heresy spreading throughout the East. A gifted writer, and having spent much time in monastic reflection, Basil authored 2 rules of monastic life and reformed the Oriental liturgy. He dedicated so much of his life to the spiritual, it was as if he lived and breathed for God alone. He died emaciated in 379, hardly 49 years old. Saint Basil is the patron saint of hospital administrators, reformers, and of Russia. He is often represented together with images of supernatural fire, often with a dove present.
From his youth, St. Basil was great friends with Gregory Nazianzen, who was born in 339 AD in Nazianzen, Cappadocia, to a very pious Christian family. Considered a very learned scholar, he was nicknamed the theologian by the Greeks.
Together with his friend Basil, St. Gregory is one of the so-called 3 lights of the church from Cappadocia. For a time, Gregory lived the quiet life of a hermit, but his thirst for knowledge led him to study too at the most illustrious schools of his time, in Caesarea Alexandria and in Athens, where he and Basil forged their lifelong friendship. St. Basil consecrated him bishop, and in 381 he accepted the See of Constantinople. Though he preferred pastoral life to the political, he suffered great trials in attempting to resolve the heretical controversies which so divided the capital of Eastern Christendom. Having succeeded to some extent, he later retired to the life of contemplation he so deeply cherished. He was considered one of the greatest orators of the early Christian Church, and his sermons and teachings on the Trinity were widely renowned, earning him the title of Doctor of the Church.
Amen.
It was on November 27, 2004, that Pope John Paul II made the highly significant gesture of restoring the relics of St. Gregory Nazianzen, one of the most revered saints of the Orthodox Church, to the Ecumenical Patriarchate in Istanbul, formerly Constantinople, where Gregory had been bishop. The relics had been forcibly taken from their resting place there by crusaders in the year 1204. Calling it a moment of rejoicing and jubilation, Pope John Paul returned the relics, along with those of St. John Chrysostom, to Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew in a special ecumenical service in St. Peter's Basilica. In addressing the late Pope at that service, Patriarch Bartholomew, who is spiritual leader of the world's 250 million Orthodox Christians, described the return of the relics as, quote, a holy act, in which an ecclesiastical anomaly and injustice committed 8 centuries ago is being rectified. This brotherly gesture on the part of the senior Church of Rome confirms that in the Church of Christ there are no insurmountable obstacles when love, justice, and peace converge in the holy service of reconciliation and unity. Well, that unity was torn apart in 1054 when the churches of East and West split. Patriarch Bartholomew and Pope John Paul both emphasized reconciliation between the two churches. The return of the relics was one important step towards that reconciliation, and Pope Benedict XVI has made Christian unity a priority in his pontificate, meeting the patriarchs of the Greek Orthodox Church of Greece, as well as paying a landmark visit to Istanbul for ecumenical celebrations with Patriarch Bartholomew himself. Among those celebrations, Pope Benedict and the Ecumenical Patriarch prayed over the returned relics of St. John Chrysostom and St. Gregory Nazianzen. While the Eastern Orthodox are preparing to celebrate Christmas on January 7th, according to the old Julian calendar, Western Christians are getting ready to celebrate the Epiphany on January 6th. It is on this day, the 12th after Christmas on the Gregorian calendar, that the Catholic Church remembers the visit of the three magi, or wise men, who arrived at the stable in Bethlehem to pay homage to the newborn Christ child. In some Catholic dioceses around the world, the Epiphany is celebrated on the Sunday after the first Saturday in January. In Greek, Epiphany means the appearance, miraculous phenomenon. For Christians, like the Star of Bethlehem, it is the shining forth of God's revelation in Jesus Christ. But just how is the Epiphany depicted in Christian art here in Italy, where some of the world's first Christians lived from the time of the Apostle Peter? Well, I talked with Christian art historian Elizabeth Lev, who says the three wise men are among some of the oldest Christian images to be found by archaeologists.
The Feast of the Epiphany is of incredible importance to the history of art, but even more so to the history of humanity. Epiphany means the manifestation. So this, from that first birth of Christ in a stable with an ox, an ass, and a couple of shepherds, we go to the arrival of the outside world that comes to pay homage to Christ. And so in the moment of the Epiphany, we realize that Jesus has come for everybody. It's the great expression of the self-revelation of God on a universal level.
So which exactly were the first Christian images that have come down to us in Christian art?
The earliest Christian images are contained here in Rome. They are catacomb images. Those are the earliest ones that are extant. Although there may be older ones, but we haven't found them yet.
So we've seen the three wise men in some of those catacombs?
The catacombs of St. Priscilla contain 2nd century, at the latest, early 3rd century, images of the three wise men, among other very, very limited number of scenes, but one of them is the three wise men. Most of the other scenes are from the Old Testament. The importance of the Epiphany is such that in some Christological cycles, the image of the Epiphany can take the place of everything. What I mean is, instead of having to show all these different images of the life of Christ, it is enough in a catacomb chapel to put the Epiphany, because all you need to know is God came into the world to show himself to you.
Who were the three kings who went to Bethlehem?
Well, the three kings undergo tremendous interpretation, reinterpretation, and reinterpretation during the course of the centuries. As a matter of fact, they are magi, which is interpreted by us today as wise men. In the Middle Ages, the idea of kingship, and so we call them the three kings. But the word magi is the word magician. These are men who are capable of great prodigies. These are men who are already very wise. They have a connection to things that are not easily accessible to people of this world. So they're seen as something that already have a contact and understanding with the invisible and, by extension, the divine. And that these three men, who are all pagan, recognize that there is this divine moment in act. The divine is coming into the world, and they travel from far, far, far away to bring homage to that divinity, shows this recognition of the foreign, the external of the coming of Christ.
There are stories that tell us there was Melchior, Gaspar, and Baldassar coming from Europe, Asia, and Africa.
That is a later vision of the names are given to the Magi in the Middle Ages. The placement is given to the Magi almost immediately. The image of Priscilla, the image of the catacombs of Priscilla, shows the Magi, at least as we can distinguish today, we can't tell their faces apart. We can't really tell the gifts apart. The only thing we see is that one is green, one is white, and one is red. And so at this point, we see them as representing geographic space. They wear these funny hats that are indicative of foreigners. For an ancient Roman, they would recognize the hat as someone who was not Roman. It was a freedman's hat. And so here you have these three different colors, three different continents, three different parts of the known world that are not Rome, coming to pay homage to this king, to this child, to God. Later on in the Magi cycle, the Magi will also represent, and to me this is one of the more interesting aspects, the sense of magician. They represent three different philosophical systems that the Christianity, the self-revelation of God, that puts to rest or supersedes, if you will. And so one of the wise men would be represented as the Eastern tradition of Zoroaster, and this sort of very complex, exotic religions of the East and these philosophical systems that render their homage that Christ supersedes them. The second thinking system, of course, would be the great Greek system, the descended from Plato, the Hellenistic tradition of thought. And again, they bear gifts and they render homage to the truth that that is greater than theirs. And then finally, the last of the Magi would be Daniel, and would represent the Old Testament, recognizing the arrival of the fulfillment of the scriptures in Jesus. But the Magi are everywhere. They are everywhere. In the early years, you'll see them transform from a hastily painted fresco on a catacomb wall to the carved sarcophagi. If you were to ever go to some place like the Pio Christian Museum of the Vatican Museums, you would see walls, entire walls, representing the scene of the Epiphany, because it was so important to the 4th century, 5th century people who insisted on having this image on their coffins. Then one of the most colorful, one of the most fun, interesting images of the Magi is in Santa Maria Maggiore, and you have to look a little carefully. It's on the triumphal arch above the altar, and you will see on the left and on the right, you will see the Magi. But they're not wearing the simple tunics that they've worn in the 3rd and 4th century images. They wear these crazy, multicolored, exotic costumes that look like they have sequins on them, to show, again, that idea of the exotic magicians, these people from a faraway land, from different systems, these kings, this royalty, who once again bear homage to Christ. Then, walk into any art museum in the world, and you'll start to see the Magi represented in by the best painters that Italy produced, that France produced. You can see the Magi by Roger van der Weyden, by Hugo van der Goes. You can see the Magi by Gentile da Fabriano, by Mantegna. There are so many images, because this is a story that never, ever tires. And now, as of 2006, you can go to the movie theater, so you can go to your DVD rental store, and you can see the three Magi reinterpreted one more time in the movie The Nativity, where the Magi play a huge role, but they play the role of science here. They play the role of science, recognizing the greatness of Jesus.
In what way?
Well, The three Magi in the film are represented as a group of men who are surrounded by their instruments and their charts and their books and all the things that give proofs and indications. But when they realize that something extraordinary is happening, they have to get over their reluctance to leave the safety of their laboratory, to leave things in a theoretical, just understanding state, and to go out and to physically experience the arrival of this divine manifestation. And they have no doubt, when they arrive, and the last thing they would expect, they arrive before a stable, and there, clearing away the sheep, there is a humble man and a humble woman and a child lying in a manger. And they don't hesitate, they don't look at each other with bewilderment, they bring their gifts to this child, because they see the divine.
You're talking about this movie. We've talked about other images of the three wise men in art and architecture. But it sounds to me that it's their role, or who they were, was very much open to interpretation or to fantasy in a way. I mean, do we have in the scriptures very many indications as to who they were and where they came from?
No, that's why the scriptures give us a very bare-bones account of these three Magi, these three wise men who came from afar and who brought gifts. And from there, the three men, the gifts, the gifts are a fulfillment of scriptural writing of Isaiah, but the
gold,
incense, and myrrh. The wise men, their provenance, their day jobs, they have been interpreted and reinterpreted, and that is the essence of the story, because the point of the story is the universality of Christ. And so if we could fit those three men into cages and say that these are the people that Jesus came for, then it would miss the point of being that Jesus came for everyone. So you will see images of the three wise men as old, middle-aged, and young. You'll see the three wise men as black, white, and Asian. They will be everything to everybody, because the point is that Jesus came for everyone.
Elizabeth Lev is a professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University's Rome campus. During the Christmas season, Christians turn to the Holy Land to recall the birth of Jesus. But the ongoing conflict and bloodshed there often seem to threaten the very hope all Christians share in Christ's birth. That's why it's so good to hear that the local Christian community, despite its dwindling numbers, continues to do what it can to promote dialogue and peace. The Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem, for example, has been running schools in Israel, Palestinian territories, and Jordan for over 150 years. And though the schools are Catholic, their doors are open to everyone. Their head of education, Father Majdi Siriani, told me the Latin Patriarchate currently has a network of about 40 schools in the region, many in small villages where no one else has ventured before.
The uniqueness of our mission is that we go where nobody went, mainly to remote villages. And as you know, our schools are open to everybody, to the community. Usually Christians are part of this community. Usually they are a minor part of the community. It'd be 10%, 5%. 20-30%, sometimes more, sometimes less. And our schools would reflect this demographic components of this society. We take girls, boys, and usually in these remote locations, you'd find our schools only, not even public schools, remote villages, small villages, forgotten most of the time.
It must be a huge challenge because, from what I understand, something like 10,000 new students enter the educational system each year. Something like 40% of the Palestinian population is school-going age.
Every year, when the month of May is approaching, it's a tragedy for us, because people would pour on our, you know, schools. They want to have seats for their kids, and usually out of 10 students will be able to take maybe one. We have 20,000 students. We could, you know, add a little bit to this, but we cannot afford the luxury of taking in more than a certain number. There's a lot of Christian schools. There's a lot of Christian schools, but everybody want to go to the Christian schools, especially when they know that they get better education, quality education, and not only education. It's the way you raise up these kids. I'm not talking about the Christian community only. Most of the Christian community, 99% of our Christian people come to our Christian schools, this for sure. But the other places are for the others. And the others want to have, you know, their kids to come to our schools and to be raised in our schools no matter what. Our schools are a way to witness to our Christian values and heritage, you know, in front of the other, which is the Muslim community. It's not only in Christian areas that we open schools. We have two big schools in Gaza, for instance. We have 1,300 students, mostly Muslims. And in Nablus, it's the same. We have a school, 500, 600 students. I'm not sure if the numbers are mostly Muslims, too. This, the Muslim community is our community, and we need to open up for them. And this is our way to witness. And this is our way to explain what Christianity is all about. It's our way to prepare leaders for the future who would accept the fact that Christians or Arabs are part, integral part of this community.
Catholic education in the Middle East, training for a future of mutual respect, harmony, and peace, thanks to the work of dedicated people like Father Majdi Siriani, Director for Education at the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
Listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.